Rachel Robertson is the author of Respect Trump's Harmony and former Antarctic expedition leader. Hello, Rachel.
G'day, Trevor.
Rachel, we had such a big response that you spoke to us last time, and everyone suggested that you should be Prime Minister.
Some of the Facebook messages. Oh, it was just gorgeous. I feel like I've come home with our little community there on the Facebook page. It's awesome.
Rachel, did you enjoy being a leader?
Wow. Yeah, not initially, hey? And what changed for me was changing my understanding of what leadership was. And I'd always thought leadership was like this command and control, and you had to be out the front and tell people what to do and say, follow me. And it was only when I applied for the role in Antarctica and we were on the boot camp for the week, the selection process, it went for a week, was a boot camp. And when they offered me the job, I asked them, I said, why did you choose me? And they said, we like your leadership style. And I'm like, wow, what is that? And they said, the fact that, and I must have said this, that leadership is about creating more leaders. It's not about creating more followers. And so for me, when I had that shift in my thinking, that leadership is about bringing other people up and coaching and mentoring and making them really good. And I thought, yeah, I can do that. I love doing that stuff. I don't like being out front. I don't like being in charge, but I actually like the supportive part of it. And I thought, wow, so that's what leadership is. So it was only when I changed my own thinking, and I talk to leaders, you know, all the time now, emerging leaders, and they're like, oh, I don't want to be out the front in charge. And it's like, well, no, leadership's about creating more leaders. And once you have that shift in thinking, it's really fun. It's good fun.
But can that be done at any level? Because there are different roles of leadership. There's leadership of small groups, medium groups, companies, then there's leadership in a country. Can you place that sort of formula to any form of leadership, do you think?
I think you can. I think it's a behaviour more than a title. So leadership is a behaviour more than a title. And I think there is certainly situational leadership. So there's certain situations where you need to change your style. And then sometimes you need to be a lot more assertive or a lot more outspoken and directive. And there's other times where if you've got a high performing team and they're doing okay, like particularly in a sporting team, if they're winning and they're successful, then you don't mess with that. You sort of encourage them and stick to the game plan. But I think there's situational leadership where you change your style according to the situation that you're in.
Is that the thing, though? Because you need to be able to change your style, because there are going to be points as a leader that you're going to have to take control yourself, and you're going to have to be the person that's responsible.
That's spot on. You have to take control. And equally, if you get involved in situations where you shouldn't be involved, and you know, what you do is you escalate. And I'll tell you a story about what happened in Antarctica. This was about sport being played on the radio, and whoever helped the chef in the kitchen got to choose the music, right, that played around the radio station. We call it a radio station. It was just an MP3 player. But one of the, you know, someone from Melbourne decided that when the football was on, they would stream football instead of music. And then someone from Sydney got on and decided when State of Origin was playing, they'd stream Origin. And so three people came up to me and they said, Rachel, the rule is that you pick music, not sport. And I'm like, really? And then the next day, three other people came up and said, well, no, it's your choice what you want to play. And I'm like, oh, I don't know. What do you do? What do you do? So I actually consulted all 17 of my expedition team and I said, what do you think we should do? What do you reckon we should do? What do you think we should do? And I managed to turn this into the biggest issue to hit Antarctica in 58 years. And I was scratching my head. I couldn't work out what had gone wrong. Like, why is everyone so obsessed about the sport on the radio? And I thought, oh, maybe it's just cabin fever. Maybe we've been in isolation and lockdown for so many months now, they've just gone mad. And it was only reflecting on my own leadership a few days later, I thought, wow, I did that. I did that. The reason everyone had an opinion was because I asked everybody their opinion, and I should have not been that collaborative. I should have been decisive and said, well, I'm never going to get consensus. I've got three people for, three against, so I should just make the call. And it was a big lesson for me around not always. I'd always thought, well, you can't over consult with people as a leader, and I realise now you can. So if you go the opposite extreme and you over consult and you talk to everyone instead of making a decisive move, then you elevate and escalate things, and it drags on. And it was a good lesson for me in that situational leadership.
Should you always, you know, the idea that the buck stops here, that, okay, I'm the person that's responsible. I may like to delegate. However, I need to be aware of everything that's going on around me, because eventually that idea that I'm responsible for everything that happens, and in the end it comes back to me.
That is, it's totally right. It's spot on. The buck does stop with you. You have final accountability, and you can delegate responsibility, which is a different concept. You can give responsibility to people to deliver certain things, but ultimately, if you're the leader, you are accountable. And particularly in a crisis situation or a major event, you are it. You're the spokesperson, you're the leader, you're the one communicating. So you have to be across the detail, because you need to provide that reassurance that you're on this, we're over it and we'll get through this. So yeah, you absolutely need to be accountable.
Is that one of the things that we hear and see a little bit too much within leadership roles, not only politically, but also amongst large companies and corporations, that the buck doesn't necessarily stop there and that people are prepared to lay the blame outside their own responsibilities?
We see it a lot in corporate Australia. I see it less in sporting teams. I think the coaches in Australia are really good at taking... I mean, once the players are on the pitch or on the oval, then they don't have a lot of control of what happens as a coach in the coach's box. But they still will hold themselves accountable. So if the team loses, they will front up to the media and say, yeah, we didn't commit or we didn't do the right thing. But I think I see a lot in corporate life of leaders that should have known. It happened on their watch, so you should have known. And I'm particularly thinking of banking and finance here and executives that should have known what is going on in their business and didn't. And they say, well, it was a rogue trader or it was a rogue banker. And it's, well, no, that's your job, mate. You're actually paid to know that stuff and you're accountable for that stuff to your shareholders and to your board members. So I think we do see it a lot in corporate life.
And they get paid a lot to have those responsibilities.
That's it. You hear it a lot, don't you? That's why you pay the big bucks. And they're paid the big bucks to manage and to have oversight. And yes, it is difficult. And yes, you're constantly having to be switched on. But that's if you don't want that responsibility, then don't take the paycheck.
1-300-800-222. What do you think makes a good leader? What do you expect from good leadership? Have you been in a position where you've been thrust into that position and you're not too sure about it? 1-300-800-222, our number. Hello, Alan.
Good morning. Look, what a lot of people don't realise is that if you lead, people will follow. You have to actually step up and lead. I ran laboratories with about 30 or 40 people in them. We were using high explosives, initiating compounds, all sorts of things like that, which were extremely hazardous. I was one of the first managers in Australia to have a laboratory manual, but I followed on from the people before me. They used to put out laboratory notices. I actually indexed them and put them into a manual, and we ordered the system, and we trained to the manual. The thing about it is you need to be consistent, systematic, and you need to also be democratic. The thing is that people want, they will follow you, if you lead.
Alan, the other thing that you point out there is clarity in role and the clarity of what you have to do.
Well, look, there's a thing about it. If you talk about risk management, there are four major risk areas. It's quality, safety, environment and security. You need to balance those, and the way to do it is to have your policy manual. And based on the Australian standards, particularly for things like hazardous substances, if you base your hazardous substances on dangerous goods classifications, there are Australian standards for each of the eight groups.
Alan, you're getting a bit particular in what you're saying. However, I want to go back to Rachel with the couple of the main things that you point out there. Firstly, consistency, Rachel.
Oh, I made a note of that, Trevor, and I just, as soon as Alan mentioned consistency, I just pictured Commissioner Shane Fitzsimmons from the New South Wales Rural Fire Service, or formerly from the Rural Fire Service, and everyone here will remember through this horrific summer bushfires, Shane was up front and centre at every media conference all day, every day for almost 100 days, but he was so consistent. He was poised, he was calm, he had the detail, he was consistent. And I've actually had the pleasure of working with Shane before, and what you see is what you get. He's legitimately that kind of bloke, that what you see is the man on TV is the man that you'll have a beer with at the pub. And his team, for the most part, absolutely look up to him and adore him as a leader. And it's that consistency. You know where you stand with Shane, and you know exactly what he's thinking and how he'll respond and decide. And that consistency is critical. So, yeah, I did smile when Alan mentioned that.
The other thing that he mentioned there was that there needs to be clarity of what each person's roles are and clarity in what you're trying to do. And it's important sometimes that those things are written down so that there are people can refer to and that it's clear.
Oh, totally. And I think Alan will smile when he hears me say this, but I got my scientists in Antarctica. We had 21 science projects there, and I asked my scientists to write just a one pager, a note on what is your science project? What are you trying to achieve? Because I said, I can't get the trades team to support your science project if we don't understand what you're trying to do. So in really basic English, tell us what your glaciology project is or your biology project is so we can understand. And I thought that was a pretty simple ask, but it actually took me about 2 weeks and about 5 iterations with some of the scientists to just not dumb it down, but just simplify it into really simple plain English to have that clarity of this is what we're trying to achieve so that the whole team, including the chef and the plumber, all of us could commit to this science project. And it was so important to just, I could have given up and said, you know what, it's too hard. And I understand because that there was pushback saying, well, you're diluting the hypothesis by changing this word. And I'm like, yeah, I know, but I can't get commitment unless we have clarity around what we're trying to do here. And it was really important to get it written down so we could all reference it.
Is it important, because as you say that, because you're saying that everybody knows clearly what everybody else is doing, but are there times where, because you know how, well, this is you don't need to know this, and it's almost a little bit patronising, or you don't need to know this because either you probably wouldn't understand it or we don't want you to know. Are there circumstances by which that needs to happen, or should you try and be as open as you possibly can with everybody?
I think you'd be open. I really do. And I think, again, going back to the difficult times, if you don't know something, it's okay to say, I don't know. And I think that's when a lot of leaders fall over, that they think they need to have all of the answers. And sometimes you just don't. Sometimes you just don't know. And I think it's much better to be open and say, look, we've got 80% of the information. You can't wait for perfect information to make a decision. Sometimes you've just got to go with it, with the 80% that you've got. And I think being open and saying, I don't know, but as soon as I do know, I will communicate that back to you. And I think that's a really important thing. But there are times where if people want to know the detail, and I've worked with people like that who need to have perfect information, 100% need to know the detail, well, then it's your judgment then as a leader to say, well, no, I'll give you the task and this is what you need to do for your job. And let me deal with this stuff. And sometimes you've got to be pretty blunt about that.
Yeah, because, I mean, in some cases, I don't need to know what the managing director of the ABC does, and I probably wouldn't fully comprehend all of the things that they do. However, it's good to get some information, but you have to also leave your leaders to do their job and you do yours.
And it's true. It's about that task. I call it that task appreciation. We need to understand the tasks that people do. We don't need to know in any sort of detail. And I hear a lot with payroll. Payroll's a classic. People say, what do payroll do all day? You know, it's automated. The payroll's automated and we only get paid fortnightly. So what are payroll doing in there? And I say to them, well, if you want to know what payroll do all day, go and sit with payroll for an hour and you'll learn that their emails don't stop, the phone doesn't stop. There's constant inquiries about overtime and information that they need to provide. And I learned that one in Antarctica where with my plumbers, people were saying, well, what do those plumbers do all day in winter when they're not making water? And I said, well, let's ask the plumbers, what do you do all day? And at the time it was just to, you know, break up the boredom and keep my team motivated. But I realised how important, like when I reflected back and I thought, wow, that's so important, because my whole team could tell you with a fair level of confidence how every other member of the team contributed to the overall task and the overall goal of our team. They didn't have to know the absolute detail, but they could sort of say, yeah, I know what this person's doing to contribute to the overall picture. And I think that's important. Having people hook onto the overall goal or the overall picture for the team is really important. But, yeah, you don't need to know the absolute detail.
Owen, hello.
Yes, good morning, Ted and Rachel. I suppose this applies in particular to professions, especially politics, where credentials and prestige are kind of more important than in other roles. But what I'm interested in is how a leader balances the activities of his subordinates, in the sense that I've seen political and other leaders who have been totally kind of, you know, sort of weakened, allowed themselves to be manipulated by their deputies and all that to settle scores with other members of the team. But conversely, there are some times when, you know, say maybe even your own deputy is undermining you, and you've got to keep people on. You had people who kind of had your back, and you've got to listen to them, even if you believe the best of that other person. I hope I'm making myself making sense.
Yeah, I mean, politically, it's people who perhaps would like to be leaders themselves, or perhaps don't necessarily agree with what you're doing, and so they'll undermine their leaders because they've got their own agendas.
That's right. Yes.
And that can happen in corporations as well, Rachel.
Absolutely. And that's the book that I've just written, Respect Trump's Harmony. And it's about challenging that. And you might recall last time I was on, we were talking about no triangles, which is the simple rule of I don't speak to you about Trevor. If I have something to say to Trevor, I go directly to him. I don't take it to a third party. And as a leader, that's something you should instill with your team, that culture of if you guys have an issue, you sort it out yourselves. By all means, if you can't sort it out, then bring it to me. But as a principal, as a first port of call, you should always go directly to that person and not whinge and moan and complain behind their back to your mate, you know, over in the next office. And that builds that respect in the team. And I've always been upfront about that respect does trump harmony, that it's more important that we respect each other than that we love each other. And that gets rid of the politics. It actually dilutes a lot of the politics by saying, I don't have to agree with you. I don't have to believe you. I just have to respect. Yeah, you're entitled to that opinion, and yeah, respect trumps harmony.
Rachel, within that though, because I understand that will work, but theoretically, and I'm sure it does in practice as well. But some people just love to bitch about other people, and some people like to, well, not only going to say like to undermine, but do undermine in a lot of occasions. So is there a point by which those people need to be confronted? And even further down the line, is there a point by which a leader needs to say, I don't think it's appropriate that you're here?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think even if you don't have a formal leadership role and you don't see yourself as a leader, so you might be you're a team member when you don't have a leadership role, you can still do no triangles yourself and just say, if someone comes over and starts to bitch and moan about somebody else, you can say, look, I'm flat out right now, I don't want to hear it, and walk away and do the no triangles. And our research has shown it frees up so much time, but more importantly, energy, because those conversations are exhausting. And if you've got someone constantly whining about someone else to you, it is exhausting. And so just being able to say, no, I don't want to hear it, I'm trying to practice these no triangles, don't talk to me about it, that frees up so much time and energy. And yeah, sometimes it does become a performance issue where you have to sit that person down and say, that's not how we work around here, mate, you know, and give them a warning and say, that's not how we work, that's not how this team operates.
If you'd like to join us as we take a look at leadership, how it is that we become better leaders, what it is that makes good leaders or bad ones at that as well, 1-300-800-222 on text 0437-774-774. Rachel, I've got a text here and I'll get you to explain it to her for me because I'm not sure that I completely understand. The text says, it's Dave here, leading, ? It's not the responsibility, it's the liability that matters.
Yeah, I interpret that to mean there's a risk factor there. I think that's what we mean there. The liability is around the buck does stop with you, and you know all liability stops with you, and you can't wash your hands of things and say, well, you know, it wasn't me. If it happens on your watch, then the liability stays with you.
And that's part of the job of the leader.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's, you know, you put your hand up for that. It's fine to put your hand up and take the extra pay, but with that comes responsibility, and with that, you know, comes that liability that you'll be held accountable for your decisions, because your decisions affect lots of people. So you should be held accountable.
Is it okay not to be a leader?
Absolutely, absolutely. And for some people, it's not for them. And they don't need to. No, we can't all be leaders. And I think it's absolutely fine to say, I'm more than happy to play that support role, and I'm more than happy to be the team member who encourages and supports and mentors the newer staff. And even that in itself is a form of leadership. But you don't have to take on that formal title and all of the, responsibility and the scrutiny that comes with that formal leadership role.
Is it important to recognise that, though? Because sometimes I think there's almost an expectation on all of us that, oh, well, you know, you should be taking on a leadership role, or you should be striving for a leadership role. And if you don't, then it's almost like you look down upon.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? And it is. It's a bit of a culture here in Australia that we do. I hear it all the time that you should aspire to be a leader. And it's similarly, I hear people say you should aspire to have this big life. And it's like, well, no, I'm really happy with what I'm doing right now. I don't need to have this big life. I don't need to be a celebrity and be famous. And I think it's the same thing. You don't need to. No one has to be a formal leader. You can demonstrate leadership behaviour by all means. You know, and I think every one of us, we do that at home or in our community. Or at work, we all show leadership and we all demonstrate leadership behaviour. But you don't have to take on that formal title if it's not for you. And it might be, you know, again, situational. There might be a time in your life where you're either moving out of the workforce and retiring, or you're at home with a young baby and you just don't want the responsibility of a leadership role. And that is perfectly fine. That is absolutely fine.
Tony, hello.
Good morning. I found in my leadership roles that responsibility gains respect. Responsibility in taking responsibility for the job that you're doing, and also giving responsibility with encouragement to people that are working, shall we say, for want of a better word, below you on your job site, which I don't mean to belittle anybody. But I work with a team of around 9 people at Nucleus, and we, 2 or 3 of us have come up with an idea of how to run the job and the best way to run the job. But it might not be what I want to do, but it seems to be better that way, and we'll pick that way to go. But if it goes wrong, then I'll take responsibility, because I was the one that said, right, we'll do that way. But and that gains a lot of respect from the other team members. And consequently, if you give a responsibility to one of your team members with encouragement, you can't let them go on their own, because it's just they can sink and swim, and that's even more demoralizing for them if they sink.
Tommy, can I just ask you, when you ask people for ideas, you go with that idea and then it doesn't work, instead of coming down on that person, just recognizing, say, well, okay, this worked, that didn't work. But if you make sure that you encourage people in that way, it means that they'll then come up with other ideas?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can actually show them where it went wrong, you know, and in my job, I lay asphalt on the roads. In my job, we can fix it very quickly. If it's going wrong, we can fix it very quickly. So, you know, it's not hugely, it's important, but for a roundabout, for instance, there's probably 20 different ways of actually asphalt in a roundabout. So, you know, if you can come up with a good way to asphalt a roundabout, then you go with it. If it starts going wrong, then you can change, and you can actually say to that person, well, look, that was your idea to go with that, and this is where it's just going wrong, that little bit there. If we'd have gone this side or that side, it might have come out a lot better. But you cannot tell them that you idiot. You just cannot belittle them, and you cannot belittle them in front of the other team members. If you want to talk to them or give them a ticking off, you take them aside and you talk to them. You don't actually scream and shout at them. It's the worst thing you can do, and that responsibility gets the respect. Whether you give responsibility or you take responsibility, you will always get respect off the people with encouragement. And I found that, you know, over the years, I got screamed at when I first started, and it's the worst professional thing I've ever done. I walked away from a job one night because the boss was absolutely screaming at me for no fault of my own. And I got up the next morning and I rang the company and I said, what do you want me to do? And they said, you'll have to resign.
Tony, I just want to go back to Rachel on a few things there. Firstly, if you're going to workshop ideas, Rachel, make sure that it's legitimate and you're not just saying, well, we want to give everyone an input and give everyone a say, but you've really got written on the side here your own agenda that you're going to do anyway.
And people pick up on that, hey? We have finely tuned BS detectors here in Australia, so people will pick up on that pretty quickly if you've already got the defined outcome and you're just trying to lead them towards that outcome.
What we tend to hear in local government and in state governments and sometimes other government forms, public consultation.
Yeah, it's a ripper, isn't it?
And you go to that meeting and you go, you're not doing public consultation, you're going to do it anyway, but you just want to make it seem like we're being consulted with.
Yeah, it's just an information session, really, nothing wrong with that, but be upfront about it because people will pick up on it and then they'll be jaded and then they won't trust you. And once you lose the trust of your team as a leader, once you lose that respect, it's really hard to get it back.
Another thing that came out of that conversation with Tony is that if you do make a mistake and that you have one of your workshop ideas worked with and it doesn't work, make sure that you encourage the person outside that, otherwise they won't contribute again.
And Tony's bang on. That is spot on. And I hear a lot of teams saying, oh, we need more innovation. And when you sort of ask a few questions and understand the culture of that team, you realise that it's not safe to fail. So they're so afraid of failure or afraid of, you know, making an error that they won't even put their hand up because of, you know, being chastised in the past, so they won't even try. And it has to be safe to fail. I work with one team who've got a fantastic culture and they say, don't ask who, ask why. So when things go wrong, the first question isn't who did it, it's why. Why did this happen? And then how do we make sure it doesn't happen again? And so the who bit is irrelevant. It's don't ask who, ask why. And I think that's a really, if you're trying to innovate with the team, you have to, you know, put the boundaries around, as Tony said, you put the boundaries around and say within reason, this is your decision-making, you know, sort of boundary, but go off and come up with new ideas, come up with a great idea and we'll listen.
In large businesses, large corporations, because you've spoken to all sorts of groups, do they talk about how ideas can actually come from anywhere? That it isn't necessarily from that particular group's task is to come up with the ideas from that. It can come from outside those areas?
And that's the strongest cultures I've seen are teams where the ideas are generated from the floor, are generated from the team at the coalface, the ones dealing with it, particularly around cost saving. I mean, you could sit at the board table as an executive team and slash budgets, but I'm sure if you went to the team, if you went to your own people who are performing the task and you said, look, guys, we need to save 5% in our cost base this year, any ideas, that team will save you more than 5%. They'll come back with probably 10% worth of savings because they're dealing with it every day. And every day they see things that could be, you know, improved or fixed or made better. And they're the ones who know. So having the ability to hear from those people and to capture those ideas is so important.
Chrissy, hello.
Morning. I just woke up, so I don't know what you've said before, but I think people maybe are born leaders and independent thinkers.
Do you think but that doesn't mean that other people can't learn the traits of good leadership?
Yeah, no, but I think there's a certain person, like Ahern, the New Zealand president, she just got her independent thought and she's such a great leader.
Well, just on that, Rachel, because you hear that spoken many times, that person's a born leader.
And I think Chrissy's hit on a really important point there that when we talk about born leaders, we talk about the qualities of leadership that people have. So resilience, self-awareness. Jacinda Ardern has a lot of self-awareness. So she knows what she's good at, she knows where she needs to call on other people for help, she knows what her strengths are. So having that self-awareness and that resilience, and you can teach those qualities, but it's just a lot more difficult to teach than, say, the technical leadership skills of negotiation and decision-making. So I think when we talk about born leaders, we're thinking about the qualities of that person and you can teach them, but it takes a lot longer and it's a lot harder. Like resilience, you can learn it, but it's a lot harder to teach than the technical stuff, the technical skills of leadership.
Rachel, when you consider those things that are learned, are those things like, okay, I could be a good leader, I'm a bit quiet, I'm good at working with people one-to-one, I'm good at working with the group and getting ideas and putting them in place, not really good at talking in public, not really good at presenting as a person that's particularly strong, are they some of the things that you can learn?
You can absolutely learn them. But the thing that the Antarctic expedition taught me, the number one leadership lesson actually, was that being an inspiring leader is actually about moments. And how I learned that was my performance review was conducted by a psychologist who met privately with all my team and got feedback on my performance. So it's brutal. It's brutally frank, brutally fearless. It has to be. And so she got feedback on my performance from all 17 members of my team. And when I met with her for the debrief, she said, look, they found you really inspiring. And I said, well, what's that? Is it how I handled, you know, this plane crash that we had, or is it that I work 16-hour days in summer? And she said, no. She said, one person mentioned their kid had a school concert, and the next morning you said, oh, did you phone home last night? How was Lockie's school concert? And then Sharon mentioned that you knew the name and hometown of all 120 people on your station over summer, and Alan mentioned that he was on kitchen duty one night mopping the floors at 8 o'clock, and you came in to get a cup of tea and you put the chairs on the table to help him out. You didn't talk to him, you just helped him out. And I was blown away. I'm like, really? After a year of my leadership, that's the feedback they gave. And what it taught me was, as a leader, people don't remember what you say or do. They remember how you make them feel. And so my team didn't respect me as a leader because I did all these, you know, I delivered a program on time, on budget. They figured that's my job, you know, or I kept 120 people safe through summer. They figured that's my job. What they respected me for were these moments and just making them feel valuable. And it blew me away because I always thought to be a great leader, you needed to be an extrovert. You needed to be a big personality like a Richard Branson, you know, a really loud personality. And I didn't realize that introverts can be just as great as inspiring leaders because it's how you make people feel. That's what they'll remember years later. Yeah, it blew me away.
At the same time, though, if you have a very public position, you need to be able to, number one, express yourself effectively, and number two, to give off an air of a leader, I guess, of what we perceive a leader is to be.
And that's absolutely correct, and particularly during tough times. So when we had this plane crash that I just mentioned, my head was spinning. My head, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, I have no idea how to lead. I was leading a search and rescue to find these people who were stranded 500 kilometres away, and my head was spinning. I'm like, oh my goodness. But if I had gone out to my team and they said, oh, what's happening? And I said, well, I don't know. I've got no idea. I've never led a search and rescue. That doesn't instill confidence and poise. And I think even now as a mum with my son, I need to have that poise and confidence during this lockdown and say, we will get through this. And your shoulders back and your head up and that calmness and optimism that we'll get through this. And that's what I had to do with my team in Antarctica. Say, look, we got this, and let them know this is what we're doing. These are our plans for a search and rescue. But I think it applies to any leadership role in the home or in the community or in the workforce, that when it's tough, that poise, because people are looking to you and they'll pick up cues from your behaviour. So if you're panicking and your behaviour's all jittery and oh my goodness, and you know, that doesn't instill confidence. And I think that's a really important factor that you've just raised about that calmness and the optimism. And yeah, we'll get through this. We will.
This is an interesting point from Robin, and it's interesting to hear from you who talks to leaders how you deal with this sort of thing, saying I've been in a position, the opposite end of quite a few times, where people have claimed my successful ideas as their own and then claim the glory. And I've heard this happen within middle management of organisations, Rachel, where people will come up with an idea, it'll be taken on by another manager who will then take the glory, and you just don't know where to go as a person further down the chain.
Yeah, that's a tough one, and it happens a lot. And, you know, I don't know if I'd hang around if I had the ability to leave. I would approach it, you know, once, maybe twice. I'd go to the person and say, hey, you know, that would have been really nice to get a bit of recognition there. But if that's a cultural thing that it's actually accepted in that team, it's a lot. It's really hard to be the sole, you know, the sole voice standing up to that kind of behaviour. It's so dysfunctional. And if you have the opportunity to leave, I think, you know, sometimes it's fine. Leave, go, save your sanity.
Can you be damned if you do and damned if you don't? I was thinking about the Prime Minister and when the bushfire started not long ago, and there were questions asked about why he wasn't here and why he wasn't leading from the front when a lot of what was happening was state-based. And I understand that there's a role of a leader's whether or not they have something to do directly. There's a leadership role within that. And then when we came to the coronavirus thing that was happening now, he was sort of told that he shouldn't be interfering too much in the states and that it was state responsibility. So it seems that as a leader, especially in things like of a country and of large organisations, you could be damned if you do and damned if you don't.
It's a fine balance. It's a really fine balance. And that judgment is so important. I think the most important message is you need to be seen to be leading, and whether you have an active role or not. And I think Christine Nixon will vouch for this during the Black Saturday bushfires down in Victoria, that even the police don't have a large role in fire response in most states. They sort of look after the road closures and evacuations, but it's the fire agencies that actually manage. They're in charge. And if you follow the command and control system to the letter, then the Commissioner of Police has very little input. But you still need to be seen to be leading. You need to be present. You need to be, you know, in the background of the briefings and actually seem to be leading. And it's a really important point that, yeah, you can be damned if you do, damned if you don't, but you need to be seen to be leading and getting information out there regularly, you know, every couple of hours if you can. And even if that information is an update to say, look, I have no further information, otherwise people fill in the gaps. And often that gap filling is worse than the reality. So you need to just get the information out there.
And that collaborative process that we've seen through what's happening with COVID-19, that there be a federal cabinet by which there are leaders from all the states as well as federal leaders, which is not only seen by us as the people that are being led, so to speak, as being cooperative, but it also a great leadership style within itself in listening to what everyone has to say. All that's how it is perceived from our side. I don't know what goes on side.
Yeah, I perceive that as well. And I perceive that the big difference is that nuance around it's not one size fits all. So what's happening in this state is different to what's happening in that state. And that's great. We understand that. If there's logic and a rationale for it, all of us will say, yep, totally get that, which is a different scenario to a bushfire where, you know, that bushfires cross boundaries and that they don't respect lines on a map. And so it takes a lot more of that collaborative approach. And I think we learn every time this country, every time we go through adversity, we learn some new things. And I think we certainly learned from the horrific summer we had. And I'm really proud of our leadership team across the country at the moment, because I think they are collaborating and they're listening and taking on board information from all sorts of experts. And it must be a really tough gig at the moment.
And what we're seeing as well is clear messages, both from the states. And I know it took a little while, because I guess yeah. What happens with all of these things is it takes a little while to actually find your feet and try and work out how the message is put forward. But once it's been established and sorted, there was a good period of time where the messages were clear for us. It was coming clearly from the states and that was understood, and it was coming clearly from the federal government and that was understood.
And what a difference that makes, that we've come back to that clarity that we started with at the start of the conversation, that clarity is so important, and people will listen and they'll follow, as our first caller said, you know, they'll follow the leader if the leader has that consistency and that clarity. And I think that's where we're at now, where the clarity of the message is really strong. And it's a different message for each of the leaders, but there's still a common goal, and that is to stop this virus and to stop the infection rate. So, yeah, it's been a fascinating case study in leadership.
And for those of us that are on the receiving end, it makes us know that what we have to do, but we also feel comfortable with the people that are leading us, which is great.
Yep, spot on.
It's always good to talk, Rachel. Thank you.
Thanks, Trevor. Thanks for having me. And I've got another name for you too, Brett, with one T.
Oh, no, it's got to have two, doesn't it?
Oh, I did a book signing recently, and you say, who should I make it out to? And he said, Brett. And I said, wrote B-R-E-double-T. And he said, oh, sorry, it's one T, as in Brett Michaels, the lead singer of Poison. So if you've got any listeners who spell their name Brett with a double T, hit me up, because I've got a book sitting here on my desk I need to get rid of with Brett with two T's on it.
Just as lucky it wasn't a Matthew.
Oh, my God. It's a minefield, huh?
Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Trevor. Take care.
Rachel Robertson, author of Respect Trump's Harmony.